Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine finding out your accountant is actively stealing money from your business,
Right.
and your grand solution to this crime is to buy them a faster calculator and maybe rewrite the employee handbook.
You mandate a new, training seminar on ethics or something.
Yeah, exactly. But you deliberately avoid actually firing the person or calling the cops. It sounds completely insane, doesn't it?
It really does. But it's actually, well, it's pretty much the exact framework modern police departments use.
Right, to handle officers who break the law. Welcome to the Deep Dive, everyone.
Glad to be here with you.
Today, we are stepping into the role of your personal legal researchers. So, if you live in a city, you pay taxes, you watch the evening news, we want to help you decode these official narratives you're always hearing around police reform.
Because there's a lot of noise out there.
So much noise. We're exploring this really dense, fascinating article by Eric Sanders. It came out on April 22, 2026, and it's titled Accountability Without Consequence.
Which is such a striking title.
It is. Now, a quick disclaimer before we get into the weeds here. Policing and reform, they are obviously deeply polarizing topics.
Very much so.
So today, we are putting politics aside entirely. We are not taking a left-wing or right-wing side, and we aren't endorsing the author's worldview.
Right. Our mission is just to impartially unpack the legal and systemic arguments in the text.
Exactly. We want to understand what the author identifies as this massive blind spot in modern policing. And that core theme is the critical difference between institutional reform, which is fixing systems, and personal criminal accountability.
Which is actually punishing the actors. And that distinction, that's the engine of this entire piece.
Yeah.
We are looking at a system where city governments have completely mastered the vocabulary of reform. I mean, they know exactly how to talk about it.
Oh, totally. They roll out the new body-worn camera policies. They publicize these specialized training
Right, they build those
modules.
incredibly sleek compliance dashboards.
Yes. The dashboards you can just click through online. But the text argues that all this dashboard building, it actively avoids one specific thing.
Personal penal consequence.
Right. Putting the actual human being, the officer who willfully violates someone's constitutional rights, in front of a criminal judge.
Because if you think about it, how is it possible that a department like the NYPD can be, heavily monitored, constantly audited, officially reformed on paper?
But unconstitutional policing still persists on the street. It doesn't make sense until you look at the organizational culture.
Exactly. The author explains how organizational culture intentionally turns a constitutional failure into a mere managerial problem.
A managerial problem, sort of like an administrative issue.
Right. So, say an officer makes an unlawful stop, they search a pedestrian without reasonable suspicion.
Okay.
The institution treats that not as a crime, but as an administrative error.
Wow. So it's something to be corrected internally.
Yeah, with a reprimand. Or maybe they lose a few vacation days, or they have to do mandatory retraining.
Which goes right back to our accountant analogy. If the penalty for stealing is just having to sit through a PowerPoint until management.
The threat doesn't outweigh the benefit.
Exactly. An administrative penalty is ultimately survivable. The officer keeps their job, they keep their pension, their authority on the street.
And surviving an administrative penalty just teaches an officer procedural caution. It doesn't teach an actual fear of crossing a constitutional line.
Right.
Federal criminal charges, however, are fundamentally not survivable for a law enforcement career. And the central thesis here is that personal consequences, not paperwork, are the main driver for changing human behavior.
So these institutional reforms, the manuals, the dashboards, they aren't just ineffective.
No, they're worse than that.
The author is arguing they actually function as a shield. They absorb the public outrage, they satisfy the
And
politicians.
in doing so, they protect the individual officers from facing personal criminal law consequences.
Because by treating misconduct as a systemic failure, the blame just gets diffused, right, across the whole department.
Exactly. The official narrative just becomes, well, the system failed, so we will fix the system.
Which completely insulates the human being who actually made the conscious decision to violate a citizen's rights.
Precisely.
So, if this shield is working as intended, how do we actually spot it? I mean, how do you and I, as residents, cut through what the author calls reform theater?
Well, the text points us to a really interesting diagnostic tool. It's a recent set of findings by the Department of Justice on the Trenton Police Department,
In New Jersey.
right in New Jersey. And They don't view this as just some local Trenton scandal. It's presented as a methodological template.
A template for auditing, right?
Because when the DOJ went into Trenton, they didn't just look for isolated bad apples or, you know, just the final dramatic moments of excessive force.
They looked at the whole picture.
They analyzed the underlying architecture of the department. They wanted to see how every day minor interactions were unnecessarily escalated. They looked at the actual sequence of unconstitutional policing.
I really want to dig into how they audited that architecture, because the text spends a lot of time on the paperwork.
It does.
Specifically, how Trenton officers documented these encounters using boilerplate language. Walk us through how that works on the actual street.
Okay, so let's picture a hypothetical encounter. An officer stops a pedestrian. Under the Constitution, that officer needs reasonable, articulable suspicion that a crime is occurring.
Right. To justify the stop and a potential frisk.
Yes, but if the officer doesn't actually have that suspicion, but they stop the person anyway, they have to justify it after the fact.
You have to write the report.
They write the report.
Yeah.
And instead of detailing specific individualized behaviors, they use legally tested copy and paste phrases.
Oh, like magic words.
Exactly. They write that the subject was making fugitive movements in a high crime area.
Furtive of movements in a high crime area.
Right. Those phrases are essentially legal magic words.
Because if a judge or an internal auditor reads furtive movements in a high crime area, it technically ticks the box.
It sounds perfectly legally justified on paper. And this introduces one of the most critical concepts in the article, the records defense.
The records defense.
Police departments defend themselves through records before they ever defend themselves through the law.
Wow.
The DOJ found that in Trenton, supervisors were overwhelmingly just rubber stamping these boilerplate force reports.
Just signing off without looking.
Yeah, they weren't interrogating the officers about what a furtive movement actually looked like in reality.
And they definitely weren't cross-referencing the written report with the body-worn camera footage around.
Definitely not.
So if the supervisor just skims the paperwork, sees the magic words, and signs their name, the entire accountability structure is compromised at its foundation.
The bad stop is officially ratified. It just becomes part of the system's clean data.
It turns unconstitutional behavior into compliant paperwork.
Exactly. The system isn't broken. It's functioning exactly as designed to protect itself from external scrutiny.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. If we take that Trenton blueprint, looking at the boilerplate records and the blind sign-offs, and we apply it to the NYPD.
Right, the biggest department in the country.
Because New York has a federal monitor. They have actual external oversight looking over their shoulder. So do the monitors catch this stuff, or are they blind to it too?
Well, that brings us to a highly specific and frankly alarming piece of evidence from the text.
The letter.
The letter. On April 20, 2026, the federal monitor had to write a letter to the judge overseeing the NYPD.
Okay.
And this letter revealed a massive oversight. The NYPD had completely failed to audit stops made by their citywide community response team, the CRT.
For how long?
For 3 full years, from March 2023 to March 16, 2026.
I am so hung up on the mechanics of this because the CRT is a proactive enforcement unit.
Very proactive.
They are out there doing self-initiated street stops, the exact type of stops we're talking about. We're constantly told by city officials that having a federal monitor is proof of progress.
Right.
How on earth does a heavily monitored department just conveniently forget to audit its most aggressive unit for 3 years without anyone noticing?
To understand the mechanism of that blind spot, we really have to look at how data is generated and what a monitor actually does.
Okay, break that down for us.
According to the monitor's own findings, self-initiated stops, where an officer decides to stop someone without a 911 dispatch, has the lowest rates of constitutional compliance across the entire department.
Which makes sense.
But if an officer doesn't fill out the specific stop report for that interaction, the data simply doesn't exist in the department's compliance matrix.
Wait, so if you're walking down the street in New York and you get stopped by a CRT officer, you'd assume there's a paper trail protecting you.
You would.
But if they don't file the report, or if the department intentionally excludes that unit from its internal audit pile, the monitor has nothing to evaluate.
Nothing at all. The monitor only sees the paperwork the department chooses to generate.
That is wild.
Failing to audit specialized units effectively hides ongoing constitutional violations from those external monitors.
Because the paper doesn't exist.
Right. When police stops are undocumented, it actively prevents the courts from holding the department accountable. You can't adjudicate a constitutional violation if the internal machinery ensures it's never recorded.
It's kind of like, it's like having a health inspector who watches the kitchen staff drop food on the floor, writes it down on a clipboard, but has absolutely no power to actually fire the cook.
That's a good way to put it.
Or actually, in this case, the inspector isn't even allowed in the kitchen. They're just reading a menu the chef typed up and saying, well, the menu looks compliant.
Exactly. The author emphasizes that a monitor's role is strictly to track institutional compliance.
Not to enforce the law.
No. A monitor can observe, they can report, they can demand retrospective audits, which is what happened after this 3-year CRT failure was discovered.
Right.
But a monitor does not function as an executive with direct disciplinary power. They do not indict people.
So the very existence of the monitor is actually proof that the internal safeguards failed in the first place.
Yes.
Yet city officials constantly spin the monitor's presence as proof of transparency and progress.
It's optics. The monitorship is really just supervision standing in for consequence. It's external management where internal integrity failed.
Okay, so if monitors are just passively tracking paperwork, and the department isn't even reliably turning in the paperwork for its highest risk units, what are the actual legal tools meant to hold people accountable?
That's the million-dollar question.
The text makes a very sharp distinction between two different legal pathways here, and I want to make sure we understand the jargon. On one side, we have Title VI of the Civil Rights Act.
Right. Title VI is a powerful institution-facing tool. It prohibits discrimination based on race, color, and national origin in programs receiving federal financial assistance.
Okay, so it targets the institution.
Yes. Its enforcement structure is administrative and civil.
Meaning it goes after the institution's wallet.
Exactly. It threatens a department's federal funding, it mandates sweeping structural changes, and it can force a department into a consent decree.
But,
and this is the vital distinction here, it is not a criminal statute.
It doesn't put anyone in jail.
No. It does not place individual officers or the managers who rubber stamp those false reports in penal jeopardy. It threatens money, but it doesn't criminally charge anyone.
And the text notes that in December 2025, the DOJ actually narrowed its Title VI regulations, right? Making it even less of a structural threat.
It did.
So Title VI is basically the city paying a massive administrative fine out of the taxpayers' pockets just to make a lawsuit go away.
That's the reality of it.
On the other side of this legal divide, the text points to something called 18 U.S.C. Section 242. What is that?
Section 242 is the federal criminal statute for the willful deprivation of constitutional rights under color of law.
Wait, under color of law, does that just mean they're wearing a police uniform, or is it more specific?
It means they are actively using their official government power and authority to act. When a police officer stops you, they are exercising the authority given to them by the state.
Okay.
If they willfully use that authority to violate your constitutional rights, that is a federal crime under Section 242.
This is about real justice, then. This isn't a compliance dashboard.
No, this is the FBI Civil Rights Squad. This is a grand jury.
This is forcing the individual bad actor to actually stand before a judge and face real prison time?
Yes. And the core disconnect the author wants you, the reader, to understand is that systemic reform will always remain incomplete without these individual criminal prosecutions.
Because structural changes, like new body camera mandates, they just fail to deter individual officer misconduct.
Because the officers know the system is fundamentally built to protect its own. They know the city would rather write a check or, you know, submit a compliance plan than see them face criminal exposure under Section 242.
I keep coming back to the why of all this. If the legal tools for criminal prosecution exist, if Section 242 is literally sitting right there on the books, why does the city prefer this elaborate, wildly expensive theater of monitoring and reforming?
It's a great question.
Because as a resident, you are footing the bill for this booming reform industry. We are paying for the outside counsel, the monitoring teams, the data reviewers, the consultants.
To answer that, we have to look at the political economy of monitoring. City officials actively prefer institutional management over holding individual police actors personally liable.
Why?
Because the police are the central instrument of political legitimacy. I mean, think about how mayors govern.
They govern through the police. Public order, subway safety, neighborhood visibility.
Right.
If the department doesn't project an image of control, the political leadership looks weak.
Exactly. Putting officers in jail is politically destabilizing for a city's leadership. It threatens the internal command culture of the department. It causes massive union pushback.
But writing a new training manual?
Writing a new training manual is politically safe. It allows City Hall to hold press conferences about progress and oversight.
Without having to normalize a world where their own enforcers genuinely fear the criminal law?
Precisely. The city has calculated that it is better to contain and financially absorb constitutional failure rather than truly end it through prosecution.
Which creates this massive disconnect between the official reform narratives and the reality for city residents.
It severely impacts long-term public trust.
Right. We are told, as residents, that we are getting accountability. But what we are actually getting is supervised deficiency.
That's a perfect term for it.
The city pays millions for a monitor to tell us what's broken. The department promises to fix it. They conveniently fail to audit the highest risk units. The monitor eventually reports the failure, and the cycle just continues.
And that lack of personal consequence is exactly what erodes public trust over the long term.
Yeah.
When residents see a system that constantly corrects the department's paperwork while leaving the human machinery of abuse completely intact, they recognize that the legal system is selective about punishment.
The public is constantly invited to believe that one more layer of oversight is equivalent to justice.
But supervision is not accountability.
So how do you, as a resident listening to this, identify the illusion? How do you spot the difference?
The author gives us a pretty clear litmus test. It helps you distinguish between a department that is merely monitored and one facing actual justice.
Okay, what's the test?
If you're watching the news, and the mayor or the police commissioner is talking about dashboards, training modules, and compliance matrices, you are looking at optics.
You are looking at a monitor department.
Right. But if they were talking about individuals facing penal exposure under federal law, if officers and the supervisors who covered for them are facing actual criminal charges under Section 242.
Then you are looking at real consequences.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Until that line is crossed, the author argues, cities like New York will continue to live in the space between reform and reckoning.
The current accountability structure is incredibly sophisticated in its diagnosis, but intentionally cautious in its consequence.
That's exactly it.
We have covered a lot of dense legal ground today, so let's briefly recap the journey here.
Good idea.
We started by unpacking the critical difference between fixing a system institutional reform and punishing an individual personal criminal accountability.
Then we used the DOJ's Trenton report to look at the mechanics of the records defense,
showing how boilerplate paperwork masks unconstitutional escalation on the streets.
Right. And then we applied that exact blueprint to the NYPD, exposing how the department's failure to audit its highly aggressive CRT blinded the federal monitor for 3 whole years.
From March 2023 to March 2026. And finally, we broke down why the city's political machinery prefers the safe, expensive theater of federal monitors and Title VI compliance over the harsh, destabilizing reality of individual criminal prosecution under Section 242.
It really is a profound structural critique of how modern cities manage police misconduct.
It is.
And it leaves us with a final, provocative thought to mull over.
I love these. Let's hear it.
If a city's political leadership fundamentally relies on the police department to project an image of safety and control to stay in power,
yeah,
is it even theoretically possible for that same political system to willingly subject its own enforcers to individual criminal jeopardy?
Oh, wow.
Or does true accountability require an entirely separate, non-political mechanism to enforce the law, one that doesn't answer to City Hall at all?
It really makes you wonder. If the person stealing from the cash register is also the person guarding the front door, maybe rewriting the employee handbook was never going to fix the problem in the first place.
Exactly.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We will catch you next time.